Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And on this Martin Luther King Day, you've no doubt heard by now that the nation's most revered living voting rights icon is questioning the legitimacy of the presidential election. It's Congressman John Lewis of Atlanta, who was beaten and had his skull fractured by police, if you don't know this history, in the nonviolent voting rights march that he led in 1965 that came to be known as Bloody Sunday because of the actions of Alabama state troopers. Now, Congressman Lewis is taking a leading role in opposing the normalization of the presidency of Donald Trump. You know by now, I'm sure, that Lewis said he will boycott the inauguration for the first time in his career. That's the inauguration of any president, Democrat or Republican. And you know that Trump tweeted a response calling Lewis all talk and no results and saying Lewis, quote, should spend more time on fixing and helping his district, which is in horrible shape and falling apart, not to mention crime infested, unquote. We want to play for you a longer version than the little soundbite that you probably heard in the news. One of the things that we do here on a regular basis, longer soundbites than you usually get. So here is the 2-minute heart of Lewis's exchange with the host of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd.
Do you plan on trying to forge a relationship with Donald Trump?
You know, I believe in forgiveness. I believe in trying to work with people. It's going to be hard. It's going to be very difficult. I don't see this president-elect as a legitimate president.
You do not consider him a legitimate president. Why is that?
I think the Russians participated in helping this man get elected, and they helped destroy the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. I don't plan to attend inauguration. He would be the first one that I miss since I've been in the Congress. You cannot be at home with something that you feel that is wrong.
That's going to send a big message to a lot of people in this country that you don't believe he's a legitimate president.
I think there was a conspiracy on the part of the Russians and others to help him get elected. That's not right. That's not fair. That's not the open democratic process.
He's not legitimate, though. How do you accept working with him under any circumstance?
Well, it's going to be very hard and very difficult, almost impossible for me to work with him.
Can you imagine ever sharing a stage with Donald Trump? Donald Trump came to you and said, you know, I want forgiveness here. I want your trust, or I want your, you know, would you take him to Selma?
Well, by going to Selma, like President Bush, President Clinton, President Obama, maybe he would learn something. Maybe he would get religion.
3 different excerpts that we strung together to give you a sense of the heart of the John Lewis appearance on Meet the Press yesterday. And it's worth noting that this was the second time in the past week that Congressman Lewis took a leading role against the incoming administration. He took the unusual step as a member of Congress of testifying against one of his colleagues, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, at Sessions' confirmation hearing to be Attorney General. Here's 30 seconds of that.
Those who are committed to equal justice in our society wonder whether Senator Sessions called for law and order would mean today what it meant in Alabama when I was coming up back then. The rule of law was used to violate the human and civil rights of the poor, the dispossessed, people of color.
And Lewis went on in response to Sessions seeming very affable in his own testimony at his confirmation hearing and the fact that he is pretty well liked by Democrats and Republicans in the Senate alike, personally. Lewis said this.
It doesn't matter how Senator Sessions may smile, how friendly he may be, how he may speak to you. But we need someone who's going to stand up, speak up, and speak out for the people that need help, for people being discriminated against. And it doesn't matter whether they're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American, whether they're straight or gay, Muslim, Christian, or Jews. We all live in the same house, the American house. We need someone as Attorney General who's going to look out for all of us and not just for some of us. Thank you for giving me a chance to testify.
Congressman John Lewis in Senate testimony on Wednesday as Trump continues to make himself a lightning rod 4 days before his inauguration. We should say that this is not the only transition news. And perhaps significantly, Trump told the Washington Post yesterday that his Obamacare replacement bill will include, quote, insurance for everybody, unquote, that drug companies will be forced to negotiate on Medicare and Medicaid prices, and that his insurance law would bring, quote, lower numbers, much lower deductibles. And he said his bill, including these things, is very much formulated down to the final strokes. So we'll talk about that, too, as we welcome now Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine, an MSNBC political analyst and author of the book What's the Matter with White People? Finding Our Way in the Next America, and Jennifer Rubin, who writes the Right Turn column for The Washington Post. Hi, Joan. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be here again.
Thanks, Brian.
Joan, the headline of your article this weekend says the nation's greatest living civil rights hero says what others won't. And you ask, will other Democrats follow? How is John Lewis being different from most Democrats here?
I think in using the word, you know, not legitimate, and I think in also explaining it in the careful, calm way that he did, you know, I think that he is saying what I hear from other Democrats, but what they're not quite ready to say out loud. And I think he has led the way. I mean, Congresswoman Barbara Lee of Oakland joined him in saying that yesterday. You know, and I think now we've got about 18 Democratic Congress members saying they're not going to attend the inauguration. So, you know, I think he's expressing a really kind of widespread fear, and it's not just among Democrats. I mean, this issue of Russian interference in our elections is profound. Nothing like this has ever happened before, to our knowledge, and the ramifications of it within our intelligence agencies is enormous. And I think that members of Congress seem quite literally shaken when they come out of these briefings, but they can't share with us the details of what they know that we do not. And so now we're in this kind of breach where you have people, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is absolutely not, you know, a shrill or, you know, extremist person. She's been very protective of the intelligence agencies and you know, is just a very cautious Democrat, saying that she actually believes I don't know if she said she could prove, but she believes that the interference definitely affected the outcome. So when you have leaders saying things like that, I really don't know what the next step is, Brian. I honestly don't. But I think people were relieved that John Lewis gave voice to both these feelings and said out loud that he's not a legitimate president.
You said 18 Democrats won't be attending the inauguration. I guess that's 18 members of Congress. But that's out of more than 200, including
right.
The House and Senate. I should say for our local audience, three of those members are from the New York delegation, Gerald Nadler, Jose Serrano, and Nydia Velazquez. But that's not very many. And Bernie Sanders, for example, was on ABC This Week yesterday and said he will attend. And he's focused on policy going forward. So how divided, Joan, do you see the Democrats being over this issue?
You know, I don't think they're divided about the extent to which they will work with Donald Trump. I don't think they'll be able to. You know, I think everyone respects what Congressman Lewis is saying and the opinions of people who are not going to go. But, you know, they haven't made that choice, or some of them haven't made it yet. I think Senator Sanders is actually taking a very singular stance in a way. He's continuing to say that he believes he can work with him, when other people who said that at first, including Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, have kind of pulled back from that and said, you know, they really have major doubts. The notion that he's going to come forward with a stimulus, with an infrastructure plan that's going to be palatable to Democrats is kind of ridiculous. I would also add that Congressman Espaillat, our new congressman in Harlem, has said he's not going either. So that makes four of our New York delegation.
Thank you for reporting on that. Jennifer Rubin, you wrote in the Washington Post that Trump fell into Lewis's trap, revealing his own inhumanity and Lewis's nobility. Do you think John Lewis set a trap for Donald Trump?
I think John Lewis, as one of the iconic leaders of the civil rights movement, perfected the art of using the media, using public spectacle to shame white America, to bring us to our better selves. And I think he knew precisely what kind of person Donald Trump is. He knew he would lash out. And I think he demonstrated once again that the way to beat Donald Trump is not to shake your finger and say what an awful person he is, but to reveal and shame, reveal and shame. And that's very analogous to what he did during the civil rights movement. One thing that hasn't been talked about much that I found equally disturbing, and I wish the media would focus on this a bit more, is that he assumed, because Congressman Lewis is an African-American congressman, that he represents a district, as he put it, that's a mess, that's infested with crime. I know the 5th Congressional District of Georgia very well, and it's vibrant. It has museums, it has parks, it has two major universities, it has a thriving business community. Donald Trump understands nothing about the congressional district. He understands nothing about black America, and he operates on racism. That is a racist assumption he made, and I would like to see more made of that, frankly. I do.
Let me jump in for 1 second on that point, because I see we have a call from somebody who comes from that district in Atlanta. So since you said more people should talk about that, we're going to let Carol and Teaneck get the next word, and then we'll come back and let you complete your thought.
Correct.
Carol and Teaneck, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. It is an honor, and I'm humbled on this anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. To be speaking to you about one of the finest people I've ever met in my life, and that is Congressman John Lewis, and about my home for 36 years. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, the comments that the speaker just made. I can't.
Jennifer Rubin,
that.
Washington
Jennifer,
Post columnist.
Thank
Go
you,
ahead.
Jennifer. I grew up in a family that had one of the most significant businesses, sandwich shops, in the Central Business District of Atlanta for 30 years. I grew up living both in suburban Atlanta and in John's district. Atlanta is one of the most diverse and amazing cities in this country, and it's always been a leader. John Lewis speaks truth to power, and to say that Donald Trump doesn't begin to understand cities or black America, or most of us, doesn't even begin to describe his disconnect. It is outright racism and disrespect of the highest order. But it's not just Atlanta. The language that he uses casts disparaging light upon any major city, because major cities tend to be more ethnically and culturally mixed than rural communities. But I think that in attacking Lewis, I mean, if anybody, and I believe that the other commentator was right, I don't think that Trump begins to even care what comes out of his mouth or the way in which he attacks. And I do believe that John Lewis is smart enough to understand exactly what Donald Trump is and what he represents. And I'm so thankful that we have his moral leadership now, and that he will continue to speak out. And I would hope that in doing so, more Democrats, and I know that there are Republicans in this country, both elected and non-elected, who feel that this is unacceptable and wrong. And
Carol, if Trump tries to make a serious policy point around these kinds of things, sometimes it's that most of the major cities in this country have elected Democrats to be mayor as well as members of Congress time mm-hmm. and time again, and the cities still have all these problems that they have. So
absolutely.
Why not blame the Democrats and try something new?
We can look at rural communities across this country with horrible crime, domestic violence, lack of jobs, failed infrastructure, who time and time again elect Republicans. And they are in as bad a shape as whatever Armageddon-like environment Donald Trump is alluding to. There are endemic problems in our country with effective use of government. And one could say that in the last, it's manifested it's manifested more since I believe the election of Barack Obama, where you've had one political party that has decided we're not going to do anything if it means success for points on the other side.
And there was
a way you never had before. And I know that's another conversation,
right.
But as someone who grew up in politics in Georgia and worked on the left end of the spectrum, nothing I ever got done happened without involvement from the right end of the spectrum. But when you have a political party throughout this country in all kinds of different ways, and that's not to say that Democrats are all saints, but when you have a decision made that exploiting the weakest makes it easier for you to achieve what you want, then where their most concentrated voices, cities, that will be a louder cry.
Carol, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And still with us are Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and Jennifer Rubin, right turn columnist for The Washington Post. And Jennifer, I know we took that call kind of in the middle of a thought that you were laying out before. So if you want to pick up where you left off, feel free.
Well, the caller, I think, very eloquently, I'm not sure I could do better than that. I will say one thing, however, and that is I think the reason for John Lewis's or the premise on which John Lewis said that Donald Trump was illegitimate having to do with the Russian conspiracy, if you will, that is alive and well, and I suspect will be Trump's undoing. I don't know if you're listeners are aware of the interview that Donald Trump gave with the Times of London yesterday, in which he ridiculed and Angela Merkel, said that he would trust Russia in the same way he would trust Germany, once again called NATO obsolete. This is a mouthpiece for Vladimir Putin. Putin has been trying, Russia's been trying for decades to sever the U.S.-EU relationship, to create doubt amongst Europeans that Americans would be there, and to put his country on a plane of moral equivalence with the West. And that is what Donald Trump is doing. One of the things that is most disturbing, and I come from the center right, is that Republicans, I think, in Congress who are not denouncing this have lost their minds and their backbone. For decades, Republicans have been the ones to call for a strong national security policy. For decades, they have called for U.S. leadership to check the influence of malevolent powers like Russia. Where are their voices now? We have John McCain, we have Lindsey Graham, occasionally two or three others, but where's the rest of them? Where's the great Tom Cotton, the new leader of the right? Where is Mitch McConnell? Where are these people? They have completely sacrificed whatever principles they have, whatever patriotism they have, to go along and get along. And it is the most shameful display of party over country that I have seen in my lifetime.
So those are very strong words. And Joan Walsh, for you as a commentator from the left, I wonder if there's a corollary critique, which might be that it's usually those Republicans who the Democrats see as overly hawkish, start with Lindsey Graham and John McCain and go down however much of a list you want, that the Democrats are usually pushing back against and saying, no, we should try to have good relations with Russia and Iran and, you know, name your country who gets puffed up into more of an enemy than we have to puff it up into. It's usually Democrats saying that kind of thing. And now, because there's perhaps partisan advantage for the Democrats, they're all of a sudden the big Russia hawks. Would you make that critique?
I don't think I would, Brian, because I think, you know, first of all, there's a little bit, I'm not saying you're doing this, but there's a little bit of a caricature of Democrats in there as being like peaceniks or not concerned about enough about national security. Yes, I am somebody who's more inclined to diplomacy, and I think, you know, until the last year or so, perhaps, Barack Obama was doing his best, you know, knowing that there was a rising threat, fighting it from the Russians, fighting it with sanctions. I think that the facts have turned. It's not a matter of partisanship. It's a matter of Russia has been behaving in more threatening ways than it had before. The world is changing. Europe is changing. And Democrats are adjusting to that. And so, you know, I know that there are some people nominally of the left, like Glenn Greenwald, who's been incredibly skeptical of all of this talk of a Russian conspiracy. You know, I remain somebody who thinks it's important to have the best relationship with Russia we can. But as Jennifer says, this has been Putin's agenda to weaken this alliance, to weaken NATO, to weaken the EU. Angela Merkel said today that, you know, we in Europe have to see ourselves as on our own in the wake of Trump's remarks. You know, I think the world is changing. And, you know, I think Democrats and more dovish folks like myself have to keep up with that change, you know. And I applaud Jennifer from her own position on the center right, keeping up with the change and being such a strong voice against Donald Trump.
How much?
Let me add something that I think it's a very important moment for people who believe strongly in national security and see the Russian threat is to not get caught up in this. But you used to, and you used to. There is amazing consensus in Congress right now on the Russian threat. It's Donald Trump who is the outlier. And even though people who I've named who don't have the nerve to stand up to Trump directly do not share his view of Russia, and it will be very telling when the sanctions bill that is making its way through the Senate comes to a vote. If we can create what we've been longing to create for decades now, which is bipartisan consensus on foreign policy, that will be something to cultivate, not something to denigrate, not something to pick fights with new allies. Right now, I think we have a matter of national and, frankly, international emergency, and that is a American president who is not in acting in the best interests of America or the West. And I think the degree to which people like Joan Walsh and I can agree on anything and agree on this is something we should all be working to cultivate. You know, in the 1930s in Europe, they had something called the Popular Front, where everyone from bourgeoisie, small-d Democrats to communists got together to fight the scourge of fascism. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we're in a similar position right now.
Yeah, I usually think I'm going to get a healthy debate from the two of you.
not
so much today. But Jennifer, to your point, how much hope do you take from the emerging Trump cabinet? Because I see one thing that you wrote last week after all the confirmation hearings was that one after another of the nominees dealt blows to Trump's controversial national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Do you build from there to a larger thought that this is going to be a sober and realistic cabinet that might rein in these excesses of Trump?
It's hard to tell what's going on here. I think one possibility is that he is completing a casting call, not filling a cabinet, that he has these people as props to look impressive. Remember, he's very obsessed with the way people look, and doesn't intend to, in essence, allow them to do their jobs. That when they make a public statement, he'll swoop in and contradict them. That when they take a position on Russia, he'll contradict it. That he will really control foreign policy to a degree which
we really even have not seen, even going back to the Nixon administration, to run it from the White House, accompanied by people like Mike Flynn, Steve Bannon, and other people who equally don't know what they're doing. That is a very scary prospect, and it should scare the nominees who are going up there. So if you're Jim Mattis or you're Mike Pompeo or you're Dan Coats, who's yet to have his confirmation hearing, and you hear this from the guy who's going to be your boss, what are you thinking? Are you thinking, how am I going to work with this guy? How am I going to absolutely do my job? Is he kidding me or is he kidding the public? What's going on here? It's a recipe for chaos, and it's a recipe for good public servants who want to try to restrain him to wind up, unfortunately, enabling him. And that is the problem with many people who join government, that they think they can make a difference, they think they can curb the worst impulses, and all they do is provide legitimacy and enable the bad actors. And we're going to have to see whether that works out. What I have advised anyone who goes into this administration is have your resignation letter written and put in a drawer and know exactly when you're going to pull out. Frankly, if I were a nominee, I'd pull out now, but I'm not being asked to serve in the administration for obvious reasons. I think if that continues after he's president and that translates into actions, in other words, he wants to lift sanctions against Russia before Russia has, for example, left Ukraine, left Georgia, stopped undermining Western elections, then I think those people have a real moral dilemma. Do they stay and fight, or do they leave en masse? And I think it's going to be a very tricky tightrope for them to walk.
Boy, that is some scenario to predict 4 days before the inauguration. Let's take a call from somebody who I think is more supportive of the president-elect, Gary in Queens. Gary, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. It looks like I'm going to be counterpoint again. I think that the Democrats are trying to delegitimize Trump because they want to make him radioactive so that any Democrat who might think of supporting his one of his bills or policies will think twice. Now, I'll tell you something that you may not know. In July, the DOJ tried to get a criminal court subpoena of Trump's servers because they thought he was doing illegal bank transactions with Russia, and they failed to get it. But at the same time, Comey was refused a grand jury because the DOJ wouldn't let him have a grand jury, and that didn't give him a chance to file subpoenas for evidence that he needed, and what was a plain...
With respect to, I'm sorry, Clinton or this Trump banking question?
Sorry?
With respect to what, the grand jury? Clinton emails or this Trump banking question?
No, it's separate. We all saw that there was very probable cause of violations of law with Clinton, but they refused a grand jury for that, but they were trying to get a grand jury for this, Trump's alleged dealings.
Right. Well, let me get a response. Can either of you confirm that any of that is factual?
No,
Joan Walsh, are you familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with that, no.
No. There's something that doesn't make sense here, quite frankly. Jim Comey was not getting a grand jury together for Hillary Clinton. He was conducting an investigation in order to make a recommendation to the Justice Department as to whether they should pursue prosecution. That's not a function that the FBI would do. The FBI doesn't impanel grand juries. So something there doesn't make sense.
All right. At the beginning of the call, the caller said that those Democrats who were trying to label Trump now as not a legitimate president because of the hacks are doing so to try to make it hard for any Democrat in Congress to go along with any Trump policy proposal. And by the way, we have some listeners chiming in to say there are even more members of the New York delegation now who've announced that they won't attend the inauguration on Friday. In addition to the three that I mentioned before, we're being told Hakeem Jeffries and Greg Meeks and Congresswoman Yvette Clarke from Brooklyn. So if these listeners are accurate, and I can't vouch for their accuracy, but we have listeners telling us that three more New York City members of Congress, oh, and one from New Jersey now I'm seeing, Bonnie Watson Coleman,
right.
In addition to the ones we mentioned before. So there's a growing list, apparently, probably on the heels of this John Lewis statement and his back and forth with the president-elect, growing number of Democratic members of Congress from our area who won't be attending. But on the question, Joan Walsh, of this word, delegitimization, not a legitimate president, John Lewis said, saying we have to get to the bottom of the Russian hacks and any Trump collusion, if there was any, is one thing. Calling Trump reprehensible for having run a campaign based so much on bigotry and hints of authoritarianism and his boasting about sexual assault, all those things, are different from questioning the legitimacy of the election. So what does that term actually mean to you if you say Trump isn't, or even if you hear John Lewis say Trump isn't a legitimate president?
It means that he doesn't deserve the respect and the deference that normally comes with the office. It means that people should continue to question how he got there. It means that, yes, Democrats and Republicans should question working with him. It's not illegal. It's not, you know, John Lewis nor I, we don't have the legal power to declare him legitimate or illegitimate. I think it's more of a moral judgment, Brian, than anything else. But I think it does focus, it keeps the focus on the very, very disturbing circumstances under which he became president-elect. I can't say president for another few days, and I wake up every morning hoping that, that something will prevent that from happening, to be honest with you. I still do every day. It's unlikely, but, you know, I think a lot of us are really, really shaken by what we've learned in the last 2 months about the extent of Russian involvement in this election.
You noted in your article that President Obama's former campaign manager, David Axelrod, spoke against the illegitimate label, saying it would play into Putin's hands by delegitimizing not just Trump, but our democracy and foster the cycle of destruction of our institutions that Putin would desire. Does he not have a point?
He does not have a point. That's ridiculous. We shouldn't tell the truth about what we're seeing. Look, Putin has won in that sense because he has spurred a question, major questions about this man's legitimacy. But I'm not going to let Putin win by saying, oh, I'm going to pretend. I'm going to pretend not to know what I know so that David Axelrod feels more comfortable in the world and mainstream pundits can go on TV, you know, reassuring themselves that we're the people who really know what's going on in the country. I mean, you know, this is inflammatory. It's not the same thing. But if Putin had our president or one of our leaders assassinated, I mean, he took a role in choosing our president. He had a major role in choosing our president. That's something that we should all be talking about, even if it makes people on TV uncomfortable.
Jennifer, do you agree that Putin had a major role in choosing our president? Because one could argue that we don't know if the DNC and John Podesta emails changed the outcome of the election. And people, certainly Trump supporters and some analysts, are arguing that they were pretty low on the list of what voters were basing their decisions on. This was not the James Comey letter or any major revelations about Hillary Clinton that even came from these emails. So what was in these hacks that tens of thousands of people may have even found decisive?
Well, when you win the presidency by about 77,000-78,000 votes, which are what it would have taken to flip three critical states, everything makes a difference. It makes a difference that Hillary Clinton didn't go to some of these states. It makes a difference that Donald Trump was able to use, as you point out, James Comey's intervention. And yes, the WikiLeaks, I'm sure, did influence some people. He thought it was important enough to bring it up over 140 times as he was campaigning. But let me go back to your initial point, Brian, and here's where I do part company a bit with Joan. I think there is a difference between being morally illegitimate
and being someone who does not have the full authority powers of the presidency. We will never know how much Vladimir Putin affected the election, and we will never know how much James Comey affected the election. I think it is worth repeating that this is a man who does not have national consensus. He was a minority president, lost the popular vote. There were a lot of shaky circumstances, and that would not, I think, be the basis for calling him illegitimate, if not for the fact what he is doing, what he is standing for, how he is conducting himself. He is morally illegitimate. He does not carry the moral suasion that a president usually gets. We respect the office, and I think people like Bernie Sanders are probably right to go to the inauguration. as painful as that may be for him, I understand. But I think it is better, rather than focusing on did it change people's mind one way or the other, and Donald Trump loves to have that argument, to talk about him as a morally illegitimate president, mm-hmm. In particular because he's not defending America. The irony of all this is he ran on this rather obnoxious phrase, America first. In fact, he's running on a Russia first presidency. And I think right and left should begin to make that very clear, that he is not acting in the best interests of America. He is not performing the duties of commander-in-chief. He is facilitating, enabling a committed adversary of the United States. And that alone renders him morally illegitimate.
I know we're over our scheduled time. If I could hold the two of you for just another couple of minutes to ask about one other thing, and my guests are Joan Walsh, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine, and Jennifer Rubin, who writes the Right Turn column for The Washington Post. Jennifer, Trump's interview with your paper yesterday and these things he said about insurance for everyone and forcing the drug companies to negotiate price with Medicaid and Medicare, those sound like Democratic Party positions on the point of Medicaid and Medicare having negotiating power for price with the drug companies. Republicans have resisted that as government intrusion into the marketplace for years. But then again, I read this and I think, well, Trump's words often don't mean anything. So what do you make of it?
I think this is Trump U all over again. I think he's a scam artist. He promises better health care, cheaper, easier, simpler, newer, shinier. Whatever he is describing does not exist in any universe that I'm familiar with. He makes these elaborate promises. And ironically, this is going to come back to haunt the Republicans. Just as many Democrats became overly enthusiastic, including the president, about selling Obamacare, and he got very tripped up on this, you can keep your doctor. Think of what is going to be said now when Republicans come out with whatever their actual plan is. And Democrats say, but Donald Trump said it was going to cover everyone. Donald Trump said it was going to be cheaper. Donald Trump said, and they'll be right, because Donald Trump has created this fantastical being that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And now Republicans, I'm sure, you know, poor Tom Price and Paul Ryan are in a cold sweat right now trying to figure out how they're going to meet expectations.
Right, because they're on the other side of some of these particular issues.
Correct.
So Joan Walsh, last word. If Trump really does propose a bill, and he said to the Washington Post that he's got a bill almost ready to go, I guess people will start calling it Trump Care once it comes out. And he's for Medicare and Medicaid having negotiating power for price with the drug companies for the first time. Should Democrats work with him?
He's not going to have a bill. I mean, he doesn't have a bill. I mean, I defer to Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live the other night when he played Trump and said, I've got a bill all written. It's called we're going to get rid of Obamacare and pass the Affordable Care Act. You know, I mean, that's essentially what he's describing, only making it, you know, better in ways that we would all appreciate, except you can't do all those things at the same time, you know. So It's a fantasy world to imagine that Trump has a bill that's going to, you know, lower deductibles and lower premiums and, you know, force drug company. I mean, I would love that. That would be one, in my opinion, that would be great. But he doesn't have a bill to do that. He will never write a bill. He will never put his mind, you know, through the exercises it would take to, you know, make a formal proposal like that. So I don't think anybody has to worry anytime soon about what they'll do when he proposes it. He won't.
I don't want the government messing with my Obamacare. Joan Walsh, Jennifer Rubin, thank you very, very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian.